everybody. Please help support the show. We have some links to get yourself some Foria CBD wellness stuff where we get a kickback in the show notes. We also have some Lust Cinema links, same thing. I am offering my unblocked course on moving through creative blocks with a self-consent practice that starts on May 15th. I love teaching that class. It's probably my favorite class. It's pretty cool to watch artists find each other and talk about their imposter syndrome and their inner critics and kind of watch each other be like, wait, but you're so talented. Why do you feel that way? Oh, maybe I can turn that around on myself and notice that I also am really talented and I still have imposter syndrome. Also, I am now on Substack. I am writing more in depth there than what you see on Instagram, and I'm gonna be doing less on Instagram and more on Substack. So please do find me there. All right, welcome back. This is Share the Load. I'm Mia Schachter, the host of this show, and today I'm talking to my friend and rabbi, Aaron Levin, and I'll let you introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hey, Mia. I'm happy to be here. I don't have much else to say. My name is Aaron. I'm the associate rabbi at Nefesh, where you've been, as we say, kin, I think. Even a little bit longer than I've been the associate rabbi. I started at Nefesh last summer. I most recently was in New York, where I was a rabbinical student at the Jewish Theological Seminary and a rabbinic fellow at B'nai Jeshurun on the Upper West Side. But I'm from LA and really excited to be back here and to be back in a community that's as progressive and open-hearted and inclusive as Nefesh. It is a dream come true for me to have landed here, especially in my first role as a rabbi. So I'm very psyched to be in this role, very psyched to be in LA, and most psyched to be on this podcast.
I mean, I'm seeing you twice in one day, which is cool because we had Torah study earlier today. And it is pretty amazing to have Nefesh be like your first job out of school. I was thinking about that just because, I don't know, I know even like Rabbi Susan's sort of like she had to hop around before kind of ultimately deciding to start Nefesh.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a thing that a lot of rabbis, especially folks that are of my generation who I went to school with, it's an interesting challenge to find a place that you feel alignment theologically and ideologically and that you find yourself in kinship with the community. And the work is meaningful, I think, for many of us, irrespective of where we land. But there is sometimes more cognitive dissonance depending on what your role is, what the community is. And there are a lot of ways that my dear friends and, you know, also young rabbis have, I won't call it jealousy, but some amount of envy of where I've landed. You know, I mean, even just what you and I did today, but like for me to be able to teach a weekly Parsha class, a weekly Torah study class at this very cool cafe in Silver Lake on a beautiful sunny day every week with like a crowd that's diverse in the age of the folks that come and the background of the folks that come, like that's just not the norm. And it fills me up, right? Like it's one of my favorite parts of my week is to be at that class every week. And I mean, generally, that's what I love about this job is that on the good days, I feel very filled up by it. The way I think a lot of folks relate to jobs is a thing that pay the bills and as a way to sort of make money so that other parts of life can be joyous or meaningful. That was something that drew me to this career a long time ago, was the feeling that even on the really heavy days, the heavy days are worth it. They're meaningful. They're what I want to be doing. So, I feel very lucky to be a rabbi and to be a rabbi in the community that I'm at.
Cool. We can plug Jewel. I'm happy to plug Jewel.
You turned me on to Jewel. So for all of the local listeners, you know, come to Jewel. Even if you don't come to the Parsha class, which you're welcome to, definitely go to Jewel.
Yeah. Jewel is a queer POC-owned vegan restaurant where you can add an egg to anything.
I always say almost mostly vegan. You can add an egg.
You can add an egg to anything.
Though my coffee with folks after you left, they were like, "You can't get cow's milk." I said, "You can't get cow's milk."
Your mic is rubbing on your.
Oh, yep.
vest. Thanks. Very cool vest that I was admiring today. They don't have cow's milk even for coffee?
I don't think so. I think the options were oat, almond, and coconut, which is a very easy choice for me. Yeah. It's always oat.
I don't like oat milk. I'm not a fan. It just tastes like cardboard to me.
Oh, it's for me. It's a thickness thing. Almond milk is water.
You know, okay. Not all almond milk.
not all almond milk. There we go.
No, there's like this one brand of almond milk that is like so thick and creamy that I'm often like, uh-oh, is this cow's milk? That's going to be a problem for me and everyone around me. But I do know what you mean. It's often really watery. Also, I think worth mentioning that you met your wife at the sleepaway camp that I had my bat mitzvah at.
Mm-hmm. It's also where I met Rabbi Susan.
Oh, right.
Who is the founding rabbi of Nefesh, my boss.
Right.
But yeah, I grew up at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple camps, which is Hess Kramer and Hilltop. So I spent like 16 summers at these camps.
Whoa.
My wife Zazu was there for like 12 or 13. It's obviously a competition because my dad spent 14. So I left them both. But yeah, I mean, you know, also, because I know this is something we talked about maybe touching on, is like when I think about reasons I became a rabbi, it was like formative, meaningful Jewish experiences when I was a kid, and camp was one of those places where I just felt like it was such a joyous experience to be a Jewish kid, you know, and that played a big role in it for me.
I'm happy for you that that was the experience that you had at camp.
I know that that's not true for everyone. It's like totally, and by the way, like, thank God, more and more people talk about this, because I think now camp is evolving in ways that are important and meaningful, or at least some are. Yeah. But yes, I'm also aware of the ways that Jewish sleepaway camp is not formative for everyone. But
yeah, I mean, it was formative, but not just not always in like positive ways. And, you know, in the negative ways, it was like all the shit that kids do, regular shit, you know, like I was a public school kid. I looked really young for my age forever. I still look young for my age. And there were like the hot, popular private school girls who just like terrorized me and my friends. And I liked it until that final summer. I think I went 4 years, 3 or 4 mm-hmm. years. And I just at the end was like, wow, like why would I go back? But I'm, you know, I'm glad that you had that experience.
I mean, by the way, I like there was a little bit of that arc, right? Because when I was young, I was like, same thing. At my bar mitzvah, I looked 9 years old.
Yep.
So I definitely sort of like earlier summers have memories, you know, being bullied or like just like not being the cool kid. And thank God it evolved and changed in some ways. Also, Hilltop is a very small camp. So it ends up not being clicky, which was very mm-hmm. helpful. It's like, it's such a small, tight little community. And yeah, I think being on staff was a big part of it. Just like all of a sudden getting to be a Jewish educator as young as like 17, 18 was really meaningful. Like I actually started teaching a weekly Parsha class called Torah Time when I was 17.
Wow.
At camp every week. In fact, one of my first campers who used to come to it, and like we're 3 years apart, so like we're friends now. I was just at her wedding this weekend.
Wow.
But it was a woman named Liana Wertman, a camper then, who now runs a place called the Torah Studio where she teaches Torah for a living.
Oh.
But we used to do you know, our like theme song to Torah Time was, we just adopted the Hammer Time tune and said Torah Time. But it was like a very cool like elective activity on Friday afternoons was studying Torah at camp.
Wow.
So
that's, I would have really enjoyed that. I mean, I think also, yeah, like, as you said, had I become a counselor, I think it would have felt different to me. But whatever, I had a good time and it was formative for the most part. And, you know, it did what it did. And but I was going to ask you like why you became a rabbi and maybe like when you knew that that was what you wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. I have so many different versions of this answer that depending on, you know, where I am, I've workshopped a bunch, but there are a couple of different points. I think it sort of occurred to me for the first time in high school, because I was both a camp person, but I was also a Jewish youth group person. I was in a Jewish youth group called USY.
I also went to Jewish youth group on Wednesdays at Wilshire Boulevard.
Okay, yeah. So I was at Temple Hall.
We ate pizza and did improv. That was like...
Yeah, so that was like the sort of local version of it. And then there was like a regional version of it where like teens from all over the Southwest parts of the United States would get together like once a month for these retreats. We call them Shabbatons or a kinus, like a Hebrew word for a gathering. And so at 15, 16, I was like leading services on a regular basis. I was already giving Divrei Torah sermons like once a month because I was like very quickly the, you know, I was like the religion education vice president of the region, surprise, surprise, then became a rabbi. And then I was the president of the region. And so it was like a place where I was like putting social skills to use and speaking skills and davening skills. I wasn't like yet doing some of the pastoral stuff or life cycle stuff, but I was like sort of doing some of the parts of being a rabbi when I was like 15, 16 and like loving it. So that was the first time it occurred to me. I also like when I was at Jewish day school, I got there a few years after everyone. I started in third grade. I was there from third to eighth and then public school for high school and before that. But when I got there in third grade, a lot of the kids were like, would like roll their eyes when we'd have to like go to services. But like, it was new to me. And I was an 8-year-old who was like, this is cool. We get to like go sing for an hour instead of be in class.
I liked services too. And I remember thinking like, wow, it's so funny that other people don't like this.
Yeah, right. So I liked it. So that was the first stage of it, was like in high school. I'm like, I'm already doing this. I really like it. I got to college. I purposely sort of like put it aside just to give myself like the ability to actually go through undergrad with an open mind about like what might excite me as a career path.
What did you end up studying?
Well, I was a Middle Eastern studies major because I knew it was the thing I was interested in and that I was going to get through undergrad in 3 years. So I didn't have the time to sort of like shop around for a major, but I did take classes in as many departments as I could. In fact, I was just talking to one of our servers at Jewel is a dancer. And I was telling them that I danced in college. I took a bunch of dance classes, but I just like in general, I took classes in philosophy and religion and anthropology. Like I just was excited to like see if anything like caught my eye and pulled me in another direction. And then shortly after I graduated college, I was like, oh, this is what I've always wanted to do. I want to be a rabbi. I want to take some time to get there though. Like I felt like it was important for me to have some other life experience and to work and to do other things. So I spent 5 years between undergrad and rabbinical school, which isn't a long time, but I purposely like did something different every year for those 5 years.
What did you do? Can we get a little?
Yeah. I worked for a men's clothing company for a year. I worked for Bonobos my first year out of school. And then
no one can see your sweater, but I just want to attest that you have incredible fashion sense and fantastic sweaters. That.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's especially the sweaters. I've been working on the sweaters recently. So thanks for noticing. I was short on sweaters. then I did a Jewish Service Corps fellowship in New Orleans called Avodah. It was like attached to AmeriCorps. So I lived in New Orleans for a year. Oh. I worked for an organization called the Youth Empowerment Project. And then there was also Jewish education built into the cohort and communal living and anti-racism trainings. And especially in a city like New Orleans, it was like a really meaningful way to start learning about justice. And for me, it was like starting to think about how I would incorporate, you know, being justice driven into my rabbinate, which was still years away, but that was a meaningful step in that direction. Then I worked in LA for a company called Fulcrum Adventures, where I like was a facilitator for both school groups and corporate groups doing like team building and leadership development on a lot of ropes, like mostly outdoors ropes course trips, things like that.
Very camp.
Yeah. Well, that's how I got connected to them. I ran the ropes course at camp and they were the company that did our training.
Yeah.
So I had been a ropes course like director. And then I did this like for a year as like a facilitator. And like, while I was doing that, like did some like other sort of like Jewish community work. And then I moved back to New York where I did a year studying at a progressive egalitarian yeshiva called Hadar, Machon Hadar. So I was like studying Talmud for like 10 to 12 hours a day to see if I was like actually ready to go to rabbinical school. Like, did I like this style of learning? Turns out I really do. And then I worked for a Jewish nonprofit for like a little over a year called One Table. That's all about sort of doing 20s and 30s engagement of young Jews, but instead of it being like an organization sort of bringing people together on their terms. The whole mission was like, we're going to give folks the tools to host their own Shabbat dinners and build their own community, like using Shabbat as a way to build community across the country. So I was the New York hub manager, and that was the last thing I did leading into rabbinical school. I did a little work for them in rabbinical school as well. But yeah, I mean, I think the reason I decided like this is what I wanted to do is I thought of a Venn diagram with three sections where it was like, what am I good at? Like, what is my skill set? Was one corner. What are the things I really care about? And so I thought about Jewish community. I thought about, you know, how I could teach, how I could, you know, be a community organizer, how I could make justice work a part of my work as a rabbi. And then that leads into the third circle. Like, what are the needs of the world? Like, how can I have the most positive impact in this world, in my time here? I think it's a way that not everyone thinks of their career. And I understand some of those, for some of us, we supplement that outside of work. For some of us, it's not a priority, and that's okay. But it also felt like for me, the way a job was always going to feel like, you know, sometimes people ask rabbis, like, what was your like calling? And I know that that term can sometimes induce an eye roll, but it is a way that this job feels like more like a more than a job. It just feels like to live life and do meaningful work and get compensated for it, which is like such a gift that I don't take for granted. And, you know, I read a study a few years ago that despite sometimes the heaviness of the job, clergy people across faiths are some of the happiest professionals. Really? Because of the nature of the work. And also some clergy very much burn out because of the nature of the work, which is like why all of my mentors will tell me the importance of like doing inner spiritual work and self-care and cultivating my own Jewish life, both within the work and outside of the work. And, you know,
boundaries.
Like, yeah. All these things matter, you know, but yeah, that is all of the different answers interwoven of why I do this.
That's great. I mean, my mind went to so many different places. You know, I work with a lot of artists, and I think a lot of artists listen to this show. And I think the idea of a calling is very like dear to a lot of us. And I doubt anyone is rolling their eyes who's listening to this show. But that was also where my mind went, was like, you know, it seems very clearly to be a calling for mm-hmm. you. And I think, you know, that I have kind of circled around the idea and often kind of hit these moments where I'm like, fuck, do I have to become a rabbi? Because it feels a bit like that. And I'm like, I do think that what I'm doing now is a calling. And I don't know that becoming a rabbi is like the next extension of that. But it is really interesting to kind of like have that idea just kind of come up again and again and again and again, and even have other people say it to me and be like, shit, like, am I, you know, do I have to do that?
Yeah. Two things are true here. One is that Jewish community and faith communities in general just need people like you who are, you know, meaningful contributors, who are educators, who are people that can provide to the community and for the community without being rabbis. And we always are in need of good rabbis and more rabbis. So I'm always like, I would be so, I'll write the letter of rec yesterday. I would love for you to go to rabbinical school. We can talk about what schools I think you should go to, what programs make sense, but we can do that off the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I know someone who was a TV writer for most of her life, and she, this is Rabbi Susan Nana. She's friends with my mom, and she works at Wilshire Boulevard, and she late in life, like I think in her 50s or 60s, went to rabbinical school. So it's like, you know, never something that is like out of the question.
Never too late. A lot of great second career rabbis. I mean, Rabbi Susan was a dance professor before she was doing this. One of my best friends, my chevruta from school, I was on the phone with him since I last saw you earlier today, was a director on Broadway and then came back to rabbinical school, like switched careers altogether and was who I studied with every day for the time I was in school.
Wow. Well, and like a lot of my work is deals either head on or sort of indirectly with like a lot of Jewish themes. You know, I like my musical has a lot of Jewish stuff in it, and there's a mikveh on stage and
nice.
I get a call from a rabbi and da 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 da. But Okay, wait, there was something else that you said in there that I, well, okay. So like at what point were you like, I have to do this?
It was my first high holidays after graduating college where I just like, was like, oh, I like knew.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was more of just like a face the music moment. Like, of yeah. course, this is what I'm going to do. You know, I like, I don't think I was kidding myself, but like when I like put it on the back burner during college, like there was never really a moment where something else seriously appealed to me. I feel lucky that I had the sort of clarity that I had. And it's interesting to see how different people get to it. Like the way we were talking about that just now. And even some of my classmates when I was in school, it's like such different paths. Right. But yeah, I feel lucky that I started to know in high school and I like made mm-hmm. the decision definitively when I was like 22.
Yeah.
But then wasn't ordained until I was like a year ago when I was 32.
Oh.
It was important to me to like not come out of school like as someone who had just only been in school.
Right.
Like it felt like that mattered.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
I encourage people who are talking about rabbinical school at younger ages. I always say, like, even if that you know that's what you want to do, like, just take 2 or 3 years and, like, do a little bit, not just for the sake of being a better rabbi, but for yourself in some ways. Like, it is interesting the way people start to orient to you differently. And that started not even when I was, like, near the end of school. Like, I got into school and people start like the first time I got called rabbi was 6 months before I started school. And I was like, yo,
whoa,
I haven't started.
Yeah. Like,
it was weird enough when that happened year one, where I'm like, I've been in class for a few months. Like, please, like, let me earn this.
Yeah.
Whatever. The title itself is also like a thing that still takes some getting used to. Yeah, I think it's meaningful to take some time before committing to something that is like such a, yeah, it becomes a part of your identity. And not that some careers don't, but that other careers don't rather, but like this is now forever a part of my identity in a different way. So it was nice to have a few more years where it didn't become such a core part of my identity.
Okay. My brain is lighting up and I know that we had like all these topics that we wanted to talk about, but I think I want to go in a completely different direction.
I'm fine with that. That's great.
Okay. Well, we were going to talk about the character arc of God in the Torah, which I think is fascinating, but maybe not today.
For folks who might be interested in that, Rabbi Amy Kalmanovsky was one of my teachers, Dr. Amy Kalmanovsky, one of my dear teachers, a feminist Bible scholar. She taught a class at JTS on this subject, but she's got several great books. I recommend her.
Yeah. I'm really interested in that idea. Okay. Then we're also going to talk about repentance and ritual and restorative justice, but let's put a pin in that. I'm sure those will kind of weave their way in. I want to tell you about the phone call that I got from my rabbi the day that I passed a tapeworm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So anyone listening to this show for the first time doesn't know this, but if you've been following along, you know that I had a tapeworm for 2.5 years that I didn't know that I had, that came out after a week of like violent illness, mysterious. I didn't know what was going on. And then at the end of the week, I looked down in the toilet and there was a 2-foot-long worm coming out of my butt. Okay, that's the gory, gross part. So that day, I mean, it was truly an exorcism, like no joke, full on. I was like, I'm invincible. I can do anything. I was so full of like hope and optimism. It was incredible. I wouldn't like recommend it, but having had it happen, I'm like grateful for the experience. So that day, my rabbi, who at the time was Rabbi Jason Rosner at TBI, randomly called me. He had never really, the only other time he had ever called me was he was like, our fellow, congregants, father passed away and we need 10 people to make a minyan. Can you come do that mitzvah? Because it was such a small temple. They couldn't get 10 people together. And I said, yes, I can. So I went. So that day he called me and I was like, uh-oh, do you need someone to make a minyan? Today's probably not the best day for me. And he was like, no, I just haven't seen you in a while. I wanted to see how you were doing. And I was like, it's incredibly serendipitous and bizarre that you would call me today of all days. You know, why is this different, this day different from all other days? the eternal question. And I was like, I shit out a tapeworm this morning. And he was like, oh my God, is that why everything has been, and this is in my musical. He's like, you know, is that what's been causing everything? And I was like, I don't think so, but I do think it's what's been causing things for a certain period of time. I hadn't yet realized that I'd gotten it in Mexico and when that was and stuff. So then he goes, well, like, how are you otherwise? And I said, you know, I'm really struggling with like some things that are like aspects of my work. And one of the things that I'm really dealing with is like the way that I'm getting put on a pedestal because of what I do, and how then like when people sort of recognize, when I'm revealed to be like merely human, a lot of people seem to like experience that as a huge betrayal. And then they kind of turn on me. Like this was like a pattern that I was noticing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you shared that excerpt from your book.
Yeah. So, and he goes, oh yeah, the symbolic exemplar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we learn about that in school. Like first year of school, we talk about that term.
So I'd never heard that term. And it was like a big aha moment for me. And I was like, oh, of course you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine Zazu knows this too, like as a therapist, mm-hmm. you know, that people think that you must be like perfect at because you do it or you teach it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you get put on this pedestal, which is very dehumanizing. And then people experience your mere humanness as like they've been tricked or they've been deceived or that they've been betrayed in some way. So I would love to hear your experience with this and like your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, look, on one hand, first of all, thanks for sharing all of that. I mean, I know some of this, but, and also the serendipity of that. I know you always hear me reference TV. I'm such a huge fan of the TV show Fleabag.
Obsessed.
I mean,
obsessed.
Love that show. And, yes. You know, the scene where she says something about how she doesn't believe in God and then the painting falls off the wall and he goes, I love it when he does that.
Yes.
Not that I would gender God, but that's the actual line from the movie.
Yeah.
And I love that line. Anyway. Yes. Okay. So first of all, I'll say that I have like at JTS, I had two deans, my rabbinical school that I'm still very close with. And they all the time would tell me to call them by their first name. Right. Uh-huh. Like, especially once you're at school. One thing I loved about my teachers is they start to treat you like colleagues. They're your teachers, but they also recognize like you're entering into this path with us. And I would sometimes say to them, I would say, yeah, but I'm calling you rabbi because I have to call you rabbi. Like you're my rabbi, right? So I understand that relationship because I have rabbis. Like, you know, not only do I have my childhood rabbi who I'm still very close with, but I have mentors from various points in my life, rabbis, which was something I didn't always have. I sought that out, but now I feel very lucky to have a good group of the rabbis that I call. So I get it. I get the value of what it means to be able to trust someone to fill that role as your rabbi and how using the word can sometimes... Oh.
Wait, go back. You froze for a second.
Yeah, you froze
too. Trust someone.
I understand the value of being able to relate to someone as a rabbi and trust them to fill that role specifically, mm-hmm. right? And that something about, I'll just start talking specific about who I'm talking about, my dean, Rabbi Stephanie Riske. It's sort of mental for me that it feels different to call her Stephanie. Like, I just mm-hmm. don't do it. I call her Rabbi Riske. Mm-hmm. And it's meaningful for me, even though she'll always be like, Aaron, you know, you can call me Stephanie. My spiritual director does this too. She's like, you can call me Amy. I'm like, Rabbi, you gotta be Rabbi. So that's to say, when people call me Rabbi, I really don't correct them. The only time it sort of comes up is like, sometimes someone's introducing me to someone and like, I'll say, hi, I'm Aaron. At the same time, they'll say, this is Rabbi Aaron. And then there's like confusion. And then I have to like, I should just get better at owning it, but I'm more than comfortable with it. The flip side of this is that I worked for a synagogue in New York the last couple of years where the two senior rabbis there are dear, dear mentors of mine to this day. Rabbis Roland Matzalon and Felicia Saul, and they both went by their first names. And I also appreciated from the other perspective of like what it means for me mentally to not start calling myself, "Hi, I'm Rabbi Aaron Levin."
Mm-hmm. Like,
I really admired the humility that they both had in being like, "I'm still a human being. Hi, I'm Roly. Hi, I'm Felicia." And the way it's sort of like a certain sort of balance that comes with that, like both being having grace about receiving the role, but also like just trying to be honest about who I am. Like I am, like as you were saying, I am still a human being. So I will never have an issue with someone calling you Rabbi or Rabbi Aaron or Rav Aaron. Rav means rabbi in Hebrew. And yeah, for now, it's still my instinct to introduce myself. "Hi, I'm Aaron," because that's who I've been for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I've been Rabbi Aaron for like, I think my 1 year ordination date is like, it's a month from now. So it hasn't even been a year of like formally being in this role. And yeah, I do understand it. I do understand why it's important for people to have someone that they can trust as a spiritual advisor for their spiritual care, as their teacher. That's what the word rabbi means, my teacher, to use the title, right? Like it's, you know, for some people, it's easier to call your doctor, doctor, or to call your professor, professor, or doctor so-and-so. Like sometimes these titles have some sort of mental, emotional, spiritual effect on either the person saying it or the person receiving it. And yes, like it's a thing that is uncomfortable sometimes. And I recognize the importance of being able to own it as a, as a spiritual leader.
Right. And like the kind of it sounds like you're in a bit of like a transitional period.
Yeah.
And like that there's some, it's like there's sort of maybe before someone goes into something like rabbinical school, there's this idea that like there's a moment where now you're a rabbi and like now you feel comfortable. But I like that you're kind of talking about feeling like kind of moving through that slowly and like with awareness. And it's not like it's something that a switch gets flipped and you're like, now I'm comfortable with it. I feel like I see this so much with a lot of people in my life who are like, I just need that next degree and that next degree and those letters after my name. And, you know, and it's like at a certain point, you have to kind of find the confidence to be like, I am this thing. Like I've been doing it and I am, you know, I am a musician. Like when do I call myself a musician?
Right.
Yeah. When I can do what? Like, but there's two things that I think are kind of like interrelated here that I'm sort of like pulling out of what you're talking about. One is like, there is a very kind of like egalitarian nature to Judaism as what you've talked about, like that it's a rabbinic tradition. So like the idea is that we all learn Torah so that we can all teach and share Torah with other people, which is really beautiful. And then I think related to that is like what I was hearing when you first started talking about like, you know, your teacher insisting that you use their first name, and like treating you like a colleague, there's something that happens like with a power dynamic where like the person with less power doesn't always feel the part of that that is their responsibility to also participate in. Like you also have to treat them as a colleague. And like when you're coming from this kind of insecure place of like, well, this is day one of rabbinical school, like how you know so much more than I do, you're in a position of power, it can feel like it's the other person's response, you know, that your teacher is going to treat you like a colleague and you're just kind of going to be like, okay, like, I guess I have to get used to that. But there is also the work in you to be like, okay, well then I'm going to treat you as a colleague. And what does that mean? Like, what do I have to change in myself sort of spiritually, physiologically, you know, so that I also believe that we are colleagues?
And yeah, and you know what also does that is some of the nature of this work. Like, you know, when you can't waffle about should I be called this or not? And
I
this was one of these moments for me was the first time I walked into a hospital room as a chaplain. It was like, okay, Right. This like cute little identity crisis you're having doesn't matter actually right now.
Yeah. You can deal with it in the car on your way home.
Because I need to hold space for someone who's dying, or I need to hold space for their family members out in the hallway. And the more you do that, also the more you actually feel the authenticity in the role. And by the way, that is constant. Like, I still take a real deep breath every time I walk into a hospital room. But like anything in life, you get reps in, and you get reps in, and you start to feel like the imposter syndrome starts to go away.
I was just going to say,
in some ways, there are parts of this role. And that's one thing actually I didn't even share that I love about being a rabbi, is that every day and every hour of the day is so different. Like, to get to teach and to get to do pastoral care and to get to work with people at the end of life and the beginning of life and to do life cycle events and to do learning. Like, it's just, that's so special. So there are some parts of the work where, like, I absolutely feel like I've done a lot of reps and I feel like more and more confident. And then thank God there are ways that this job continues to humble me and will humble me for a long time. And, I'm grateful for that. You know, I try to embrace it as much as possible, even when it feels like shit, when you're like, man, I could have said something better. I could have held that space a little bit better, or maybe the teaching wasn't exactly what someone needed in this moment. And you learn from those moments and grow from them and, you know, God willing, be committed to growth. I mean, one thing that every teacher and mentor says to you as you're about to finish school is like, you need to build into your schedule time to continue to learn. Mm-hmm. You need to build into time to pray outside of work, to pray on your own. You need to build into time to work on your own, you know, spiritual direction and evolution. And I've been okay at that. Some of it I've prioritized better than other parts, but this is the type of role that if you don't keep cultivating the ways you can improve on it, you can burn out and it's harder to hold the identity. So thank God, you know, there's like a lot of rabbis for the most part, like really spread the wisdom around well of like what it's going to take to be successful in a job that, you know, sometimes people stay in for a really, really long time.
Right. Well, and I've thought about that, like, you know, you teach the Torah year after year after year after year, and you write a new sermon for every portion.
I know.
Every year.
I'm blown away by the people who've been doing this for like 30 plus years.
That's, and you're so like, cool.
How do you keep, I mean, I know it's possible because you also have to react to what's going on in the world, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the thing that's like.
And you change.
Yes.
You change.
That's one of my favorite theological pieces of wisdom is Rabbi Neil Gilman wrote this book, you know, Blessed Memory. He wrote this book, Sacred Fragments, that was all about helping people develop their own personal theologies. Mm. And he passed away a few years ago, and we had an event honoring his memory at JTS before I graduated. And all of his students who are now teachers at JTS were like sharing stories of his. And one thing he shared was, he was like, your theology is going to change at a minimum every 5 years, because as you live more life and as you experience the world and as you go through tragedy or experience incredibly joyous moments, of course, the way you relate to God, your belief in God, the way the world works is going to change with it. And so that's one thing that gives me comfort of how do I write the 5th, 10th, 15th Devar Torah on the same Parsha, is that, yeah, I mean, some of it is the intelligence that we gain just from being in the world, right? Of living more life. It's not like I have to study the Parsha 30 times and find 30 angles. I might actually touch on the same verse several of those times, but that verse will open up in new ways for me depending on what's really weighing on my heart right now. And I've noticed that.
Yeah. One of the ways that I write and have noticed that I write, you know, in the last few years, because I've been doing so much of it, is like, I'll even bring in things that I used to believe that I no longer believe. Like I'll quote myself and be like, I actually don't agree with that version of me anymore. And like, here's what I would say now.
By the way, that's so Jewish.
I know. I mean, as you were talking, I'm like, fuck, like people keep telling me like, there's something really Jewish about what you're doing. And I'm like, what? And it just keeps coming up.
You've heard me say a version of this, which is that, like, look, I'm like by no means like a Talmudist. Like some of my friends really like that was their jam. I was like more
Can
of a Tanakh.
Can you explain that, what that means?
Yeah. So the Talmud is sort of the largest corpus of Jewish wisdom. And what it is it's two groups, primarily two groups of Jewish texts called the Mishnah and the Gemara combined. The Mishnah is believed by some folks to be like the oral Torah that was passed down from Sinai until it was eventually written down and codified in the Mishnah. And then the Gemara is the commentary on the Mishnah. And if you study one page of Talmud a day, and a page is considered a front and back every day, it takes 7.5 years to learn the whole Talmud. So it's huge. It's a huge amount. And it's written largely in Aramaic. It's very dense. And then in addition to the Mishnah Gemara, what I love about the Talmud and the way it's, what I love about it is the way it's set up, the way it's oriented. And so it's going to be hard to do this without actually, okay, I'm going to pick up, I have here, I'm going to pull out a page of Talmud here, see if this can be shown. I'll still explain it to folks who are listening, but you see here in the middle of this page, that's, it says the word Mishnah there, and we have Mishnah for a while. And then right here we have Gemara, and then it's Gemara all the way down through the middle. Mm. But you can tell that this is actually a column in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then what's going on around the edges here and here are two different sets of commentaries. Mm-hmm. Now, fascinatingly, we always put the Rashi, because he's like our greatest commentator, that's always in the middle. So it's not always on the right side. Like if I bring in this page, Rashi's also closer to the middle, to the binding.
Okay.
And then on the out is the Tosafot, who are like of the generation of Rashi's grandchildren. But I share all this to say that Jewish learning and Jewish wisdom by design has been, okay, here's the primary text, the Mishnah. Then the Gemara is a bunch of rabbis who are debating each other. And we're seeing both of their opinions. We're seeing the minority opinion, even the opinion that doesn't win out, preserved. Mm. What's happening here is a discussion that involves a machloket, a disagreement. And then generations later, Rashi comments, and generations after Rashi comments, the Tosafot comment. And then by the way, there's actually another layer of additional commentaries even further out. And so what a page of Talmud is actually demonstrating for us, let me be clear. Sometimes the content of the Talmud can be very challenging. It's of a different time, and it can really be hard to grapple with the ways that it feels insensitive and not of our value system. Sometimes there actually is beautiful alignment. But what it's demonstrating for us is the ways that Jewish tradition is evolving, because before all of this is the Torah. Which is a part of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, what non-Jews call the Old Testament, we call the Hebrew Bible. And basically what they're doing is they're trying to make as much sense of the parts of the Torah that either they don't understand or that actually don't really align with their inherent value system. They're trying to make it work in the world that they live in. The two things that are happening that are so amazing is that, first of all, they're making space for people to disagree.
Yeah.
And not erase that. Like,
and form, you said before, of like form your own theology. Like you said that to someone in our Torah study today, like that doesn't fit with their theology. And I was like, man, what other religion is like talking about each individual
theology? Yes. Right. Is that like, we're like in the Mishnah, we're always talking about the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, who like were always debating. And like, meaning they were living, they had different rulings on almost every issue, meaning they were actually living different versions of Judaism, like of how Jewish law manifested for them. Now, for the most part, for observant Jews, a lot of this has been codified. But what's beautiful is that we see the ways that what the Talmud is modeling for us is the ways that we are supposed to learn with someone, with a chavruta, with a learning partner, that we're supposed to debate, that minority opinions matter, and that later generations are not only entitled to, but are responsible to continue to interpret. That's like we're growing out from this core nucleus, and the layers that happen around it, those expansions matter. So when I live in this world today, in 2024, and I see parts of our Jewish law system that don't sit with me, right? They don't sit right morally, and they don't sit well with the vision of God I believe in, because I believe in a God that views all human beings as created in the divine image, meaning all of us are equally beautifully God's creatures and are equally entitled to the same liberties and freedoms and joys and responsibilities, right? Yeah. So when some normative Jewish law doesn't agree with that, I view that as the license to say, okay, we have, I don't agree with the conclusions of the Talmud, but I do really like the playbook of how we make this work.
Right.
Because we will add layers of meaning, tshuvot, or what we call modern responsa, like answers to halachic problems. Mm-hmm. And so I don't view it as like, oh, we just have to live in a world where we have this cognitive dissonance and you know what? Homophobia has just been built into the tradition forever. It's like, no, 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 no. Very different sociological reality where those conclusions were made. We absolutely need to learn from the process, not the conclusions. Because no God that I believe in or aspire to believe in believes that differences in sexuality should afford you different rights around ritual and marriage and love and partnership. So I don't even remember how we started, but the theology's question.
Yeah.
I love the way that our most important corpus shows us how our theology can continue to grow and evolve. And you had referenced this, that we're not a biblical tradition, we're a rabbinic tradition. If we were still living by biblical law, we'd still be offering animal sacrifices and things that just are no longer of this world. Judaism was never that. Like the rabbis of the Talmud modeled for us, you know, like a very famous story in the Talmud is like a rabbi shouts out, Lo bashamayim hi, it's no longer in the heavens. We're no longer living by divine decree of the Torah. Our job is to take those decrees very seriously, but to make them make sense in the world that we live in and find harmony between ancient texts and our modern contemporary needs and morality.
Is that a specifically Reform Jewish idea?
I would say that is most closely aligned. What I just described is probably like along the lines of like the conservative movement of Judaism, which is not conservative leaning. It's just the name of this movement of Judaism. I would say the Reform movement is very much aligned with some of the, we should live a Judaism of our values, but Reform Judaism doesn't view halakha, Jewish law, as something that we are obligated to observe. They don't say we should disregard it altogether, but they have a different relationship to commandedness, Reformed Jews. You know, at Nefesh, we're a trans-denominational community, which means we're not like neatly fitting into either of these movements I just described. And we're like trying to, you know, make modern contemporary meaning from our ancient wisdom. And it turns out it's actually like a really meaningful process is like the squeezing the juice. Like that's what we do. That's why we study the Parsha every week, year after year. Like we read in our tradition, turn it again. Cause we continue to derive new meaning from it.
Yeah. So cool. Wow. Well, I could keep going, but I feel like we should.
That was a nice punctuation.
Because, yeah.
We could talk about this for,
yeah.
I mean, we will. I'll like see you next week in the week.
I know. Week well, no, week. Not next week. We're not right. meeting next
not
week.
Not meeting next week.
But no, you know, but I'll see you tomorrow. Saying, yeah.
That's right.
Well, and if anyone wants to come to Torah study, we meet on Thursdays at noon at Jewel in Silver Lake. And if anyone wants to come to Nefesh services, we do the first and third Friday night services of every month. And then the second Saturday,
what a great plug.
Not an ad for Nefesh, but you know, you're always welcome. You. Yeah.
Yeah. You really are. And for folks, I don't know when this is going to be available, but, Shabbat Shalom and, on Passover in Yiddish, we can say Azizin Pesach. In Hebrew, we can say Chag Kasher V'Sameach. We take the dietary laws around Passover very seriously. But however you're celebrating, however you're engaging in Seder rituals, I hope it's meaningful. May we continue to find liberation for ourselves and for our world. And Mia, thanks for having me. This was super fun.
Thanks, Aaron. This was great. I really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Okay, a couple things. One is that I am offering my Unblocked course on moving through creative blocks with a self-consent practice again, starting May 15th. I have gotten some of the best feedback I've ever received on that class. Sam Sundias talked about it on the podcast last time and how having, you know, thinking that you are the only artist struggling with not making enough work or not making work at all or not being able to find your voice or imposter syndrome. When you get into this class setting with other people dealing with the same, dilemmas, it's an incredibly healing thing. I love teaching this class. It's really dear to me personally, and the transformation that people go through is like, it's just remarkable. So I hope to see some of you there. Next, I am now on Substack. Please join me on Substack. You can be a free subscriber or you can be a paid subscriber. I'm writing a lot more in depth there and a bit more personally, sharing some slightly more vulnerable things than what I share on my Instagram. And I'm slowly moving towards Substack, away from Instagram, away from Instagram towards Substack. So I hope to see you there. I also highly recommend Shop NB, the sex toy shop. Here is some info from them. Shopping for sex toys can sometimes feel overwhelming, but ShopNB.com is a Black, queer, and trans-owned online sex toy shop that aims to create a better experience for the queer, trans, and gender non-conforming community. Visit ShopNB.com, ShopNby.com, to bring more pleasure and affirmation into your life. And I will put that in the show notes so that you can find it very easily. They're wonderful.